This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 7th, 2006. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Otto Bogado. Heads of the Iraq Study Group call for disincentives and diplomacy in the Middle East. The People's Assembly of Oaxaca is denouncing the arrests of movement leaders in Mexico City. And Katrina survivors demand government accountability after a judge orders FEMA to restore housing payments. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Pentagon has confirmed the deaths of 11 more U.S. troops in Iraq. Five were killed by a roadside bomb in Kirkuk. Details of the other six deaths were not provided. The death toll for Iraqis was much higher. At least 75 people were killed or found dead across the country today. That includes 48 whose bullet-riddled bodies were found in different parts of Baghdad. Meantime, at the White House, George Bush told reporters this morning he's willing to hold talks with Iran and Syria over the situation in Iraq, but only with conditions.
These countries have now got the choice to make. If they want to sit down at the table with the United States, it's easy. Just make some decisions that'll lead to peace.
Bush told reporters Washington would only speak to Iran if it abandoned its uranium enrichment program. He said a change in Syrian foreign policy toward Lebanon was a precondition of talks with Damascus. The Iraq Study Group, co-chaired by George Bush Senior Secretary of State James Baker, is recommending diplomacy as a way to help stem the violence in Iraq. The group wants talks to start without preconditions. Canada's top police officer resigned amidst major political pressure Wednesday over the case of Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen deported by the U.S. to Syria. Stefan Christoph reports from Montreal.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police top officer Giuliano Zaccardelli resigned from office amid public outcry concerning his testimony before a committee of the Canadian House of Commons on major discrepancies within his public account of the RCMP's role in the case of Maher Arar. A Canadian citizen was deported from New York City to Syria by U.S. authorities in 2003, acting on information gathered from Canadian security services who had falsely identified Arar as connected to Al-Qaeda. John Tackerberry of Amnesty International in Ottawa.
There are roles played by officials in the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, within the Department of Foreign Affairs of the Canadian government. Those people who are responsible for elements of this failure on the part of the Canadian government have to be held accountable as well.
This is Stefan Christoph reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
The Israeli army opened fire at Palestinians near the border of the Gaza Strip today, breaking a week-old ceasefire between Palestinians and Israel. From Gaza, Rami Amagari reports.
Palestinian medical sources said Thursday that two Palestinian farmers were shot and wounded after Israeli army opened fire on the northern Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses said that the two wounded were hit by Israeli fire while bending down a lever in their farmlands. Palestinian resistance factions considered the attack an Israeli violation that would undermine the ceasefire declaration. Fawzi Barhoum, spokesman of Hamas.
We have repeatedly said that if the Zionist occupation commits further crimes against the Palestinian people, the truce would be unstable.
Israeli sources claim that the Israeli soldiers manning the Israel-Gaza northern border spotted two men approaching the separation line and then opened fire on them. The Israeli government claims Palestinians have continued to fire small rockets into Israel despite the ceasefire. For Free Speech Radio News and IAMEMC.org, I am Rami Almighari reporting from Gaza.
18 Los Angeles hotel workers have begun a 7-day water-only fast as part of their push for a living wage. Tandi Chimuringa reports from Los Angeles.
As part of their efforts to secure a living wage, 18 workers from various LAX hotels began a 7-day water-only fast last evening with a candlelight procession. The L.A. City Council passed a living wage ordinance for 3500 Century Boulevard hotel workers on November 22nd, and the legislation was signed into law by Mayor Villaraigosa 5 days later, raising their wages to $10.60 an hour, or $9.40 an hour for those with health benefits. But the hotels and other business groups along Century Boulevard are now seeking to repeal the law through a ballot referendum. The workers will fast and set up shop outside of the hotels until December 12th. Jasmine Ortiz is a parking cashier at the LAX Hilton.
I'm proud to be part of this fasting because it's a way for our kids to have a future. Because if we don't have a present right now, our kids, they're not going to have a future. They cannot be sent to college. They cannot have a better life in the future. I'm a mom. I'm a head of the family, and it's hard.
For FSRN, this is Tandasiswe Shimaringa in Los Angeles.
And finally, Sri Lankan officials say 7 people were killed and 6 abducted today in the northeastern region of the island. The violence comes as the government reinvokes strict provisions of a anti-terrorism law. Poniam Manikavasagam reports.
Military officials accused the Tamil Tiger rebels for the killings of 3 civilians and wounding 12 students in an artillery fire today, a day after the government imposed the Anti-Terror Act. The government's decision to reinvoke the Prevention of Terrorism Act followed a suspected rebel suicide bombing attempt to kill the defense secretary last week. The new regulations prohibit all terrorist symbols and any contact with terrorist groups. Violators can be imprisoned for up to 20 years. Human rights activists say the sweeping powers given to the forces will damage the rights of the ordinary civilians. The rebels say the government's move is a serious breach of the 2002 peace accords. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Bounia, Sri Lanka.
And I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
Heads of the Iraq Study Group gave additional insight into their report, answering questions by the Senate Armed Services Committee. In their testimony, they leave open the door for the president to increase troop levels and for an increased presence of the Air Force during transition periods. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
In a short hearing lasting just over an hour, some lawmakers expressed concerns with the Iraq Study Group report. Some concerns revolved around the group's central premise, embedding U.S. troops with Iraqi security forces. Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, is worried about the risk U.S. troops could face.
I like the embedding concept. I think we should do more of it. But I'm just wondering, as a practical matter, whether that isn't an invitation to attack American troops that are one by one in small units.
Democratic chair of the commission, Lee Hamilton, responds. He says the embedded Americans will have American military protection.
I think you will have to have substantial capabilities to protect those advisors. And obviously, any American, every American member of Congress, I'm sure, wants to do whatever is necessary to protect those people. But you have to be candid here. And the candor part of it is when you put these men into Iraqi units, they're very exposed. And you have to do everything you can to protect them, but it's not risk-free.
The two chairs of the commission, former Congressman Lee Hamilton and former Secretary of State James Baker, suggest that troops become embedded at every level of the Iraqi security forces. They gave more details into the new roles they suggest for the troops. Baker and Hamilton said special operation forces, rapid reaction teams, and combat troops should all be readily available to protect the embedded Americans, which could mean an increase in U.S. troops. Although the report recommends combat forces should begin to redeploy as the U.S. trains the Iraqi army, and that it rejects the notion of increasing troop levels, it does keep the possibility open for the president to do just that. They also said that to provide adequate security of embedded U.S. troops, an increased role of the Air Force might be necessary. Lee Hamilton responding to questions by Senator James Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma.
Well, it's totally consistent, Senator, with everything we heard. I think we used the word support. Perhaps we weren't specific enough in some respects. But air support is clearly needed in large quantities, maybe needed in even larger quantities if we go to this embedded idea. And so that equipment has to be available and the people have to be trained for that.
If their suggestions are taken, many agreed that the risk level to American troops will rise if an additional 20,000 troops are embedded. Currently, only 3,000 to 4,000 troops are currently training the Iraqi security forces. Rafael Nubio was a sergeant in the Army until January of last year when he was honorably discharged. He conducted trainings in Iraq and said the embedded plan came a little too late.
There is such a heterodoxy of training methods that to me it's almost kind of useless to send advisors. I like the idea in theory. In practice, it's a different matter because these guys are not, these men, these women are not trained to put a country together. That is not what military training entails.
In a news conference with British Prime Minister Tony Blair in Washington, the president gave little insight into what, if anything, he'll change.
The thing I liked about the Baker-Hamilton report is it discussed the way forward in Iraq. And I believe we need a new approach. And that's why I've tasked the Pentagon to analyze the way forward.
It is possible the Pentagon is looking into the feasibility of embedding troops in their own report. The president will wait for the Pentagon report and one by his National Security Council before he makes any decisions. Baker and Hamilton told lawmakers the U.S. should do everything it can in the next 12 to 18 months to help save Iraq. The final decision, though, comes down to the president. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
After a district judge ordered FEMA to restore housing payments to Katrina survivors, the agency appealed its case. FEMA's critics say the agency is wasting tax dollars and prolonging storm victims' suffering. Yan Meixier reports in Washington, D.C.
A week after Hurricane Katrina made landfall, New Orleanian Robert Coakley landed in a Washington, D.C. apartment, paid for by FEMA.
Things were going very good. We were transitioning very well. And guess what? All of a sudden, my housing was totally taken away from me.
The shocking news came in February, 5 months after Katrina, when FEMA started to close out one of its housing programs, which covered Coakley. He felt he was hit by another storm.
Rent's four times what I was used to. Here, a $10 bag of groceries costs $19. This is what I was facing, no contacts in the city, and I thought I was going to be out on the street, and I did not know why.
In order to reapply for housing assistance, evacuees have to provide FEMA a series of documents, a process Coakley calls an absolute joke.
The appeal process was like trying to pin the tail on a donkey or trying to break the pinata. You don't know where it is, you don't know what you're fighting. It was like shadow boxing.
After dancing in the dark for days, Coakley finally hit the pinata. FEMA restored his rental benefits. However, not everyone was so lucky. FEMA denied thousands of Katrina families further housing assistance, and in the computer-generated denial letters, FEMA used phrases such as ineligible-other to explain why benefits were denied. In August, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, or ACORN, filed a lawsuit against FEMA. Last week, U.S. District Judge Richard Leon ruled in favor of ACORN and ordered FEMA to restart the housing program immediately. FEMA appealed on Tuesday. In a written statement, the agency says it has provided enough time and sufficient guidance for evacuees to reapply for help. Today, ACORN took the case to Capitol Hill, asking Congress members to pressure FEMA to withdraw. ACORN spokesperson Mary Spencer.
The lives of innocent American citizens have been jeopardized due to the negligent actions of our federal agency, FEMA.
A dozen Democratic Congress members signed a letter urging FEMA to drop the appeal. Congressman Al Green, a Democrat from Texas, says a rebuke to FEMA should come from the very top.
It's time for the president to say to FEMA, FEMA, withdraw. Withdraw this notice of appeal. FEMA works for the president. And I think it's time for the boss to come forward and say, enough is enough.
Democratic Representative Maxine Waters of California is slated to chair a House panel on housing when Democrats take over Congress next year.
I intend to make my first order of business a hearing down in New Orleans to deal with the mess that has been created, the lack of housing, the inability for residents to return, and the ineptitude and mismanagement of FEMA.
Robert Coakley says he just doesn't understand why FEMA prefers spending money in dragging out the lawsuit rather than helping storm victims.
It's silly. It's stupid.
For Free Speech Radio News, Yan Meixie in Washington, D.C.
Though some news reports say the Mexican state of Oaxaca has returned to relative calm, Some eyewitnesses say many continue to live in a state of fear, especially after numerous interrogations and arrests this week. Supporters are interpreting the recent arrests of numerous UPHOL leaders as the criminalization of the peaceful resistance movement that occupied the Capitol for 6 months. Laura Carlson is director of the Americas Program of the International Relations Center. She recently returned to Mexico City from Oaxaca. Could you describe the latest developments in the government-led crackdown on protesters in Oaxaca?
Several days ago, a group of leaders of the Oaxacan movement came to Mexico City to begin once again a process of negotiation with the federal government. One of the major demands was the liberation of almost 140 political prisoners that were taken out of state and put in prison in the state of Nayarit. Also, of course, the central demand of the movement has been the resignation of the governor, Ulises Ruiz. When they were here about to go into negotiations, the police came and arrested three of the negotiators and has taken them to prisons in different parts of the country. One of the most visible people is Flavio Sosa, who has been a leader of the movement since it began and is a member of the opposition party, the Party of the Democratic Revolution. So, of course, there was a lot of outrage about this because, on the one hand, you don't arrest negotiators.
Mexican President Calderón just recently took office. What is your assessment of the new president's attitude toward this resistance movement?
As a first message for a president coming into office, to take the path of repressing a broad and democratic and largely peaceful popular movement in the state of Oaxaca by putting its leaders in jail is a very, very bad signal. It's got everybody worried, not only people who are involved in the Oaxacan movement, but everybody who works for change, social change in Mexico. The attorney general that was appointed by the new president is named Medina Mora, and he is the same person who sent in the federal troops to Oaxaca as the Secretary of Public Security, and he's also the same person who was largely responsible for the federal government participation in the repression that took place in Atenco. And that was a terrible case that still has many, many human rights violations and accusations pending. And the Secretary of the Interior, who's handling these negotiations, also has a past of repressing movements in his home state of Jalisco at an anti-globalization demonstration where there was basically a roundup of demonstrators who were placed in prison, many of whom also suffered, according to accusations, torture at the hands of the state government. So we're seeing a collection of signs that don't look at all good for movements that are peacefully and legally asking for social change, and that could be an indication that we're going to see a right-wing government that's even more repressive than we've seen in the past.
You've called the demonstrations in Oaxaca Mexico's most important social justice rebellion in recent years, but there are reports of many people fleeing the city of Oaxaca. What impact do you think this will have on the campaigns of the People's Assembly of Oaxaca and the education workers who are occupying the state capital?
They've declared that they're going to continue. In fact, there's a major march organized for Sunday in Oaxaca, and also there will be like solidarity marches in other parts of the nation. They've found new allies or made stronger allies. For example, now that Flavio Sosa, who is a member of the PRD, was arrested, the PRD and what they call the Broad Progressive Front, which is a coalition of three political parties that protested the electoral fraud of July 2nd, has become a stronger ally. At the same time, because of the violence, particularly on November 25th, there are people who are becoming alienated from the process. There's some question about the continued participation of members of the university union. And people within the city, of course, are also scared. However, we're not really seeing a mass exodus, and the chances are it looks that the movement will be continuing.
That was Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the International Relations Center, speaking to FSRN from Mexico City. The The newly released Iraq Study Group report recommends that the United States engage in direct diplomatic talks with Iran and Syria, using incentives and disincentives for the two nations. It also states that the key to success in Iraq is to engage neighboring nations into reconstructing the country. Iranian affairs correspondent Saida Jamshidi reports.
A 149-page report of the Iraq Study Group, commonly known as Baker-Hamilton Commission, has 79 recommendations for the White House, but concentrated its effort in three key areas. A change in the primary mission of the U.S. force in Iraq that enables the United States to move out of Iraq responsibly. The Iraqi government's prompt action to achieve reconciliation. And a change to the United States' diplomatic effort in the region to engage neighboring countries, including Iran and Syria, to reinforce stability. This is for the first time that a high-ranking official committee recommended direct diplomacy with Iran since the abrupt diplomatic disconnection between the two countries in 1979 after Iran's revolution. Gary Sieg was the former National Security Council staff under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran.
I would be very surprised if the Bush administration would in fact accept the recommendation to go to direct negotiation.
But Gary Sieg also believes that continuous refusal of direct negotiations would harm their national interests in the region, and eventually the direct diplomatic talk is inevitable for both states.
I think they are very conscious. I think Iran is very conscious of the fact that if the United States leaves suddenly or in a very disorganized way, that Iraq is likely to go into an all-out civil war, which could, in the end, threaten the preeminence of the Shia, which they have just gained at some great difficulty. And I think, to that degree at least, trying to coordinate with the Americans about how this is done could be very important.
Mansour Farhang is the former Iranian ambassador to the United Nations and a professor of international relations in Bennington College in Vermont. He believes Iran is more than ready to talk with the United States.
I'm in the opinion that if Bush administration sent an invitation to Iranian government that they would want to talk to representatives of Iranian government in Geneva on a particular date, Iranians would say yes.
Farhang suggests the United States would move forward in its diplomacy with Iran if
America finds it in its own national interest to engage Iran, as the Baker-Hamilton Commission and many other leading foreign policy experts in this country suggest, then they will pursue their own interests.
According to a recent Reuters poll, Americans favor diplomacy on Iran. At the UN General Assembly last September, President Bush stated America's willingness to give diplomacy more time when dealing with the Iran's nuclear dispute. Professor Sieg believes this will not be an easy task.
It's going to be very hard to find an answer to the problem without some direct contact with Iran, and I think we should be prepared for that.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saida Jamshidi.
South Africa recently became the first African country to legalize same-sex marriage. While gay rights groups celebrated the new law as a victory against discrimination, leaders in other African states reacted strongly, fearful that South Africa's law will propel similar legislation in other countries. From Uganda, Emmanuel Okela reports that some opponents to the law are suggesting an economic and cultural embargo on South Africa.
The South African Parliament on November 14th voted to pass the Civil Union Bill, which allows gay and lesbian couples to marry. The legislation has sparked uproar in Uganda, though homosexuals have welcomed it as a great step towards their freedom. Homosexuality is illegal in Uganda. If arrested, one could serve more than 6 years in jail. A local Ugandan who has been living undercover since 1989 when he discovered he was gay told FSRN that he was happy that Africa has started tolerating same-sex relationships.
being a gay in Uganda, it is not something that is so easy, because you have to keep on in hiding. One, your family, many times you don't want them to know. The society where you are staying, you don't want them to know. Where you work, you don't want them to know, because when they get to know, you are intimidated. Yes, September I was hit. You see this? I was hit. And someone, when he went to police, he said, no, this guy wanted to fall in love with me. So you can see the problem we are in. What we are asking the government to do and the society is just to relate. They might not accept us. That's fine. Just to relate.
In South Africa, two men last Friday wedded, being the first couple to take advantage of the law passed only 2 weeks earlier. South Africa has one of the most liberal constitutions in the world. It specifically bans discrimination on the grounds of race, gender, and sexual orientation. Gay rights activists use the constitutional provision as a powerful legal tool, though South Africa remains largely conservative. Same-sex marriage has been legalized in Netherlands, Belgium, Canada, and Spain. Here in Uganda, a team of traditionalists, religious and civil society organizations have petitioned the South African President Thabo Mbeki, threatening an economic and cultural embargo against his country. One of the petitioners, Martin Semper, a leading AIDS activist in Uganda, says he's worried because South Africa operates several business empires across the continent. He fears that gay rights activists might infiltrate these companies to expand their influence.
We gave 60 days to the government of South Africa. We wrote to Thabo Mbeki and said, Mr. Mbeki, you better give people a referendum, break this law down. Otherwise, we are going to put an economic embargo in the same way as apartheid was wrong against African people. That means we will not use their phone services, we will not use their trade services, not use their. We will have a cultural embargo on South Africa. That way we can send a strong message to South African government that Africa will not embrace homosexuality. This is a continent that needs repentance. Countries that embrace homosexuality are inviting disease and death. No wonder this can explain why South Africa has the highest HIV in the world. Whoa, way! We are crying because of South Africa today.
The church in Uganda rejects homosexuality as a sinful action and has denied homosexuals the right of a Christian burial. In 2003, the Anglican Church in America ordained Gene Robinson, making him the church's first ever gay bishop. His appointment caused controversy among about 18 million Anglican communities around the world. The rift ended with the Church of Uganda severing ties with the Episcopal Church in America. But controversial retired bishop from one of the dioceses in Uganda, Dr. Christopher Senyonjo, says the God's chief law is love and that the church negates that principle when it refuses to accommodate the homosexuals.
My guiding principle, when you talk about the law of God, the chief law of God is to love. Love another person as you love yourself. So if you hate another person, you touch another person for being what he is, not because he is interfering with you. I don't see that would be the law of God.
The situation for Uganda's gay and lesbians has deteriorated in the last decade. In 1999, President Museveni instructed police to lock up and charge homosexuals. Uganda State Minister for Ethics and Integrity, Dr. James Nsavabuturo, said though South Africa has legalized homosexuality, is confident that such legislation would never find its way in Uganda. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting in Kampala, Uganda.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Otto Bogato.